You know, I think Butch has already said everything that has to be said about the conjuncture. So I was listening to him, and because it was a very thought-provoking thing about what we can do now, etc. And I was thinking that, you know, possibly what we need to do also is not just focus on the current conjuncture, which of course we do have to focus on when we're looking at policy and what we can do and so on. But maybe we also need to step back a little bit and look at this from a broader historical kind of perspective. Because I said this already yesterday, but I do actually think we are living in historic times. I think, you know, we'll be able to tell our grandchildren that, yes, I was around, you know, when this was happening. Because it is a phase of transition. Now, it doesn't follow that it's a transition to something good or that it's a transition to a completely new thing. It could well be a similar hegemonic structure coming back, maybe even with the same hegemon. But I think there's no question that there is a transition. Now, if there's a transition, then, of course, earlier phases of transition are useful to look at. And the one that we have a lot of evidence on and which is, you know, still been documented quite comprehensively is the interwar period. When we had a hegemon in decline that wasn't willing to admit that it was no longer dominant, that is Britain, okay, which had run the world economy pretty much along similar lines, that had a dollar, it had a gold standard, which was really a sterling standard. It had, you know, patterns of trade and investment, which it was more or less determining, and so on and so forth, which all of which had declined almost imperceptibly to the point where when the clear collapse came on the eve of the First World War, it was kind of caught unawares, okay, that it was no longer as important in the global economy and therefore ultimately also politically important enough to retain the leadership that it had. In that subsequent period, all kinds of things happened. Now, the economic history that many of us are taught and which probably is in your textbooks will tell you that that was a terrible time for the global economy and all, you know, it was all stagnation and protectionism and blah, blah, blah. And yes, all of those things were true. It was also the phase when the Great Depression happened. It also is the phase where, you know, various run-ups to... It was also the phase where depression led to fascism in some countries. It also led up to a global war. All of that, certainly. But it's also a phase of autonomous industrialization, okay, in many developing countries. In fact, it is the first more significant phase of autonomous industrialization in a large part of the developing world. So what I'm trying to say is that there is a complexity of response to crisis. And that's why I really liked your question, because, you know, it's true that we don't know. And that things are going to turn out differently in different, not just regions, but in particular countries and in particular spaces, in ways that are often unpredictable, even through the crisis. Which is to say that the short run impact will very definitely be adverse. And in all the ways that Butch mentioned and that I was talking about yesterday and so on, all of those impacts are very much there. But even the medium term effects are more complex. And they're more complex fundamentally because the, I won't say the, it's not that hegemony has collapsed, okay? It is not, because clearly its imperialism is still out there and so on. But it is much more, even fragile is not the word, it is more brittle, okay? It can be chipped away in different ways. And there are therefore spaces opening up. And there are a number of spaces which are opening up which do not appear as huge in the immediate instance. We tend to focus on some because we see them as institutional alternatives. But quite often the alternatives are not institutional. If you look at the interwar period, barter deals were a huge element of trade, which is why in many developing countries, trade doesn't go down, it goes up. Okay? And actually it isn't just that, you know, in countries that were dominantly primary commodity exporters, some of them become manufacturing exporters. Or manufacturing producers, which they certainly would not have been able to do. Okay. Similarly, patterns of financing that trade, again, they change in very subtle ways. Okay, and in addition to barter deals, you get currency groupings. You have, of course, they were morely in the interwar period, they were dominantly based on the old colonial ties. Okay, so Britain had its group, etc. and so on and so forth. French had the, you know, the franc zone and so on and so forth. So it was different. But you are getting already different kinds of currency arrangements. We are getting trade deals that have proliferated in the last 5 months, which in fact I don't even want to write about because, you know, somebody might notice and WTO will clamp down on them. But there are strange trade deals going on in the world today. There are strange currency deals going on in the world today. China, Argentina, you know, I mean, within Africa, within countries of Asia, there are different kinds of financial arrangements which are emerging, which are not talked about, which are happening at the margin, and which I do believe are part of different responses to this crisis. What I'm suggesting, therefore, is that we are seeing a phase where very clearly it is not going to be the same kind of super imperialism or hyper imperialism that we have lived through for the last 20 years. It is nonetheless going to be, of course it's an unequal world, of course bad things will happen and so on and so forth, but it is a world in which there are many, many more opportunities. These opportunities are not a repeat of earlier opportunities, which means that also, especially for all of you, for the younger lot, okay, basically, it really means that there have to be many more imaginative kinds of responses to how you deal with it. The past is that in that sense not a complete guide to how you can deal with the future. I just like to highlight two or three aspects of it, I think, and then I'll stop, right? Because how many minutes do I have? Okay, I just want to highlight two or three aspects of the current situation, which if I step back, have significance historically. One is that all the conditions that Kindleberger, who by the way, I do think all of you should read, I think he's a vastly neglected economist. Kindleberger highlighted in his work on the Great Depression, he highlighted three reasons why this global depression happened. Okay, he said basically, look, it's to have a stable global economy, which is capitalist, of course, he was only talking about those, you need three things. You need a global leader, but that global leader has to be willing and able to fulfill these three functions. The first is discounting in crisis. That is that when there's a crisis, you can provide the money to make sure that things don't collapse, okay? Now, it's true that the U.S. has right now displayed that it is willing to discount in crisis, okay? Right now, it has discounted immediately. It saved, once Lehman Brothers collapsed, it's gone and bailed out everybody else. But I think it's not over. I think the extent of discounting required is not known to us yet. The financial system is still incredibly weak. And it is likely that the U.S. is going to be called upon to discount much, much more, not only within its own economy, but outside its economy because of the counterparty risk, because its banks, its financial institutions will be at risk of default from people whom they have lent to as well. In addition, it's not just subprime housing, it's not just the credit card risk, it's not just the consumer credit risk in the U.S., I think the degree of financial fragility globally is vastly underestimated, and I'm willing to stake anything that within a couple of years you will see a much greater implosion, which will require much, much greater bailouts. Okay? If that is the case, if they have to do that degree of discounting in crisis, then the Triffin dilemma that Butch is talking about becomes a big issue. The amount of dollars they will have to release in the market will definitely reduce confidence in the dollar, okay? No doubt about it. But that's one, okay? So number one criterion Kindleberger had, discounting in crisis, it's still out there. It's still not quite clear whether they will be able to maintain it in the medium term. The second important criterion that Kindleberger had was counter-cyclical lending, which means that those countries that are not able to access liquidity, the hegemon has to go out there and provide it. Otherwise, you don't get stability. Now, Kindleberger, too, was not referring to all the small countries. They don't count. They are not enough to destabilize the system. So, unfortunately, Jamaica or whatever, you know, you still have to suffer. However, sufficient numbers of countries and economies and sufficient, you know, you cannot allow anything of sufficient size and weight in the global economy to actually collapse. And the trouble is that in the current global crisis, we have very large numbers of small countries that require this counter-cyclical lending and which are not getting it. Okay, we've already talked about how pitiful the IMF amounts are, and they're all with these conditions which will only make things worse and are pro-cyclical, so they will require more lending in future and so on and so forth. Counter-cyclical lending, therefore, also not being met at the moment. Third requirement Kindleberger had is that the hegemon must provide markets for those who wish to export their way out of that problem. In other words, what happens? Developing countries need that counter-cyclical lending, they get it, okay? Then they have to repay. How do you repay? The only way you can repay is by having an export surplus. So somebody must be willing to be your market. That's the job of the hegemon. Very clear. No other large economy can do it. The hegemon has to absorb all these other export markets. Okay? That's what the US has been doing all this time. But as I've told you yesterday, and which I think it's eminently clear now, it cannot do it anymore. Okay? It just can't, whether it wants to or not. And it has nothing to do with whether, you know, the Democrats are going to be more protectionist or, you know, etc. It's impossible for the US to anymore continue to absorb the excess exports of the rest of the world, okay? So what do we get? We get US cannot play this role. Fine. Can somebody else play this role? Can the European Union play this role? No. For very similar reasons. And also because, let's face it, the European Union is not a country. It is actually a bunch of countries which can't even agree on what counter-cyclical policies they should have within themselves. So forget about them playing the role of a hegemon globally. So what does that mean? It means that all the elements that Kindleberger specified in terms of what we have to have to avoid a global depression, none of them is fulfilled. The only one that has been temporarily fulfilled is the discounting in crisis through these large bailouts, but I am emphasizing temporary. I do not believe that it's even in the medium term a genuine, complete discounting that has prevented a crisis and a meltdown. Okay? So the specter of depression, shall I say, looms large. Okay? I'm not the only person saying this. It's not just, what is this man? You call him Dr. Doom, right? Rubini and others. But it is even relatively conservative commentators like Martin Wolf who are admitting that this is not over, and that there is a big set of issues out there that have to be resolved. What does that mean? It means, oh my God, okay. It means then that if we are looking towards a period of global depression, developing countries then have to think about how they respond to that. And what I've been trying to say, and I think it came out a little bit in your question, is that it doesn't have to be only bad news. Global output falling doesn't mean developing countries' output falling necessarily the same way, necessarily without any change in production structure, necessarily without any changes in the dynamics of that process. If the period of integration, stable growth, etc., did not deliver development, there's no reason to be so wedded to that period and to that same process. I think it's very important for all of us to actually shift our thinking a little bit to think about, okay, in a situation of global depression, what are the things that developing countries must do? What are the types of production that you must encourage and how? What are the types of consumption you must encourage and how? What are the ways of distribution that will enable this to be a more democratic, inclusive, progressive, etc. way? And so what I'm really asking for is an imaginative leap on all our parts to get away from what we have been boxed into thinking, which is that depression is bad, there is no alternative to the kind of, you know, pattern of growth and capitalist accumulation that we have seen, and that we cannot do anything but try and get back onto that particular trajectory. I think we are entering a phase of history where alternative trajectories are going to emerge, whether we like it or not. They're going to be different trajectories. We have to think about how to get them into progressive and, as I said, you know, democratic, feminist, etc. trajectories. But that means that we have to shed some of our older attitudes towards many of these basic macroeconomic features. So basically, you know, I mean, women are supposed to be the ones who know how to cope and where survival strategies also turn into more than just survival, turn into something creative. I think this is a great moment for doing that. I think actually all of us have to be thinking much more imaginatively about how we handle a phase of prolonged global depression, which we can actually turn to our advantage. Okay, let me stop here. I'm sure that's very incendiary, so we can get discussion.
Thank you very much. What I have is just a curious question, because we've been knowing that countries like India, Mauritius, Seychelles, that they've been having robust sectors, IT sectors, you know, where they've been involved in a business outsourcing with the United States and call centers. Has this been affected?
Again, this is a more complex issue than generally we think. At one level, yes, it's been already very badly affected. In India, for example, 40% of our software exports went into the financial sector of the US. And now that this has been nationalized, all of those fellows have been told, please look for domestic suppliers. Don't go to India for your suppliers. Obama said as much, that I want a job in Baltimore, not Bangalore, something like that. Yeah. So yes, already it's been directly affected. However, as the competitive pressures on US companies increase, they have to reduce costs even more, right? So there is that other pressure for them to actually search out the cheapest suppliers, so that even as some financial institutions and banks are reducing it, other companies are increasing it, because it does reduce costs for them. Okay, so there's that complex thing. The second thing about the outsourcing dilemma is that, you know, a lot of the possibilities and potential for software outsourcing, etc., are not necessarily cross-border in countries like India and China. Okay, four of the major software companies, who account for 84% of India's software industry, have set up offices in China. Okay, it's a more, as I said, you know, the world, it's a different world from the one that we had earlier. So it's, you can't say that it's necessarily going to collapse. Certainly it's hit, and it is going to be hit more, but it is not going to necessarily collapse in the same way.
I just have one question. Do you see any particular country in Asia playing the role of that the hegemonic or having the potential to?
Yeah, well, as I said yesterday, I mean, there's no doubt China is the only contestant, right, in this particular thing, not just in Asia, but globally. But it is not really, at this point, an adequate contestant, okay? It cannot, it's not there in that league of being a global superpower yet. No question about it. Its share of world trade is still only, what, 8% or something? Its share of world output is still very small. It cannot, okay? And it doesn't have the same even military dominance, okay, that was required. But, you know, these are not things that happen overnight. If you look at the period when people date, if you like, the death of the British hegemonic rule, it's 1914. It's when they announced that pound sterling is no longer convertible into gold, and World War started. Then, you know, that's that, everybody more or less says that was when it was very clear Britain is no longer the hegemon. But if you look at the discussions of that time, nobody mentioned the US as the new hegemon. It was either Germany or France that everybody was talking about. Okay? It's only the Second World War, the build-up. Basically what happens, the build-up to the Second World War and Hitler, etc., and then the war itself, succeed in destroying productive capacity in Europe and wiping out these two as contenders. And meanwhile, the US has come up. Okay? So it is that particular combination of forces that allows the US to emerge as this potential hegemon. And it's only by the end of the Second World War, when the US controls half of world trade and one third of world output, that it's very clear that the US is going to be. Okay? But again, it happens, it happens through a big mess. So even Keynes didn't get it until it was too late. I mean, you know, he thought, here am I, the great Keynes, I have an idea, and here's some silly economist called Harry Dexter White, who the hell is he? How come his idea gets taken? It had to do with relative power, which was not recognized. But these are processes that are complex and go through ups and downs, you know, so it's, and long. They're not processes that happen in 5 years, 10 years in the same way. So we're entering one of those phases of uncertainty.
Does that mean imperialism is over? I mean, is it end of imperialism?
If only. Look, did the end of British imperialism mean the end of imperialism? Well, that's the point, right? No, but you see, there is a rivalry. It doesn't mean that imperialism is over, but it does mean that there is much greater rivalry. There is no one hegemon, okay? I mean, what is imperialism? By the way, if you look at how Lenin defined it, Lenin did not define imperialism as a stable system. What did he say? It is the struggle of large capital for economic territory. So it's an unstable system, actually. It's just that occasionally history throws up some, you know, the big bully in the pen who establishes supremacy. But mostly it's an unstable system. You see, even that is giving it a solidity which it need not have. It's a moving world. Get ready for a lot of change. You can decide these are the four poles, and then it may not be that though some new fellow has come up, or one of the poles is destroyed, or whatever. It's not a fixed system. It is a fluid system, which is in constant contestation. All I'm saying is that gives you spaces which you don't otherwise have. Yeah. Oh my God, this time I have really finished you all off. I'm sorry. Yeah? Good time? Okay, good. So that's it.